teachers' unions fight back in the battle of how history is taught. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today's Wednesday, July 7th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota Political Junkies discuss the nuances of teaching history and literature that include insight into race and racism. We'll talk about the ongoing political influence on what teachers can and can't teach in the classroom. SDPB's Lee Strubinger heads to a sale barn for a look at the impact of drought in South Dakota. We get to know inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. We travel with 605 Magazine to Watertown's Bramble Park Zoo, plus an art collection for the state of South Dakota. That's coming a little later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
And with SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. A multinational French energy company wants to build its second wind farm in South Dakota. The North Bend Wind Project would cost up to $285 million. The Public Utilities Commission unanimously voted to allow the project to begin its permitting process. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more.
ENGIE is the company wanting to build the 200-megawatt, 71-turbine wind farm in Hughes and Hyde counties. The nearly 47-acre project is proposed for south of Harold and north of the Crow Creek Reservation and Missouri River. There were no comments or questions from the commission members, company, or public. The three-member PUC unanimously voted on a recommendation from staff to allow ENGIE to begin its permitting process.
Staff just requests the commission impose a statutory filing fee and also to grant authority to enter consulting contracts if necessary.
ENGIE has been studying the area since 2016 and hopes to begin operations by late 2022. The wind farm would have underground cables, a switching station, aircraft detection system, and other infrastructure. It would connect to a Western Area Power Administration line that crosses the southern part of the project. The North Bend Wind Project would be west of ENGIE's existing Triple H wind farm in Hyde County. The company pulled the plug on another proposed wind farm in January. A public meeting will take place at 6:30 p.m. on August 11th at the Capitol Lakes Visitor Center in Pierre. Relevant documents are available on the PUC website. For SDPB, I'm Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
New state laws add some requirements for teenagers to get a driver's license. Dan Lusk is with the South Dakota Department of Public Safety. He says the new laws are now in effect.
There is no grandfathering of any of the requirements prior to this. So it's very important for people to know that if they hadn't done what they needed to do to upgrade their licenses prior to July 1, that the new requirements are in effect regardless of which tier of a license you held.
Young drivers will now need more supervised experience. The licensing process can begin with an instructional permit. 14-year-olds may drive with that for 180 days if they take driver's education, or 275 days without it. They need 50 hours driving with a parent or guardian, including hours driving at night and in bad weather. The next step for them is a restricted permit. Those teens can only drive with immediate family members in the car for 6 months. Then they're allowed one unrelated passenger. 16-year-olds can get a full operator's license, but only after meeting the requirements of the instructional permit and driving with a restricted permit for at least 6 months. And in today's weather, we have patchy fog before 10 a.m. in the west, with otherwise sunny skies. Cloudy through the morning and gradually clearing in the northeast, and cloudy but gradually becoming sunny in the southeast. Going into tonight, we can expect a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms before 7 p.m. and midnight in the west, and partly cloudy skies in the northeast, with mostly clear skies in the southeast. We have highs in the 90s in the west and upper 70s to lower 80s in the east. We have lows in the 50s and 60s. For listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Lori Walsh. MIDCO launches a new 10G broadband initiative in the Sioux Falls area. SDPB's Laura Johnson was at Tuesday's launch event, and she joins me now inside the Kirby Family Studio at SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. Laura, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us exactly what 10G is now.
10G stands for 10 gigabytes per second. So 5G stands for fifth generation. 10G ramps up the gigabytes per second and is supposed to help with creating faster speeds across the internet. I spoke with President and CEO of MIDCO, Pat McDara, just about how exactly they're going to implement this 10G.
Let's just say we go to a rural area we're not at today, or a new development at the edge of a city is developed, everything's going to be fiber to those. So they'll have the latest, greatest. Retrofitting, which is upgrading, is a little more labor intensive and takes more time. So say if you're in a central part of the city with telephone poles, with cables and stuff, that'll take a little longer to get done. So, but if you're fortunate enough to be a place where coming that's brand new, you'll have it right away.
Who is investing the money and how much of an investment is this?
MIDCO is a private company, and they're investing about $500 million into the project. And MIDCO is in five different states, so they're kind of spreading it out among those five states. In South Dakota, they are investing $200 million just in this state and $100 million just in the Sioux Falls area. So they have 12 communities that they're currently, they've already started kind of implementing 10G, communities like T, Brandon, Canton, and Elk Point. And then once they are done with this area with upgrading and implementing new 10G technology, they're going to expand to places like Mitchell and hopefully Rapid City eventually.
You also talked with Representative Dusty Johnson, U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson from South Dakota. He was at this event. You got to speak with him there?
Correct. Yeah, he was super excited about the entire project. He's very excited about what it looks like from an economic perspective.
Some industries, like healthcare, like the technology sector, are particularly hungry for bandwidth, and they are going to thrive, they are going to grow in the kind of communities that feed them that bandwidth. And just having Sioux Falls and, frankly, the other Mid-Continent communities in South Dakota have this excellent, I mean, up to 10 gigabits per second, that is unbelievably fast. That is 10 or 20 times faster than people were even envisioning just a few years ago. That is going to create a lot of economic opportunity.
So, Laura, how does this fit into the national picture of what's happening across the U.S.?
So MIDCO is not the only company coming out with 10G. There's three companies back in 2020 that, such as Mediacom, Cable Lab, and NCTA, or the Internet and Television Association, that already rolled out 10G. They did this big demonstration in Iowa. So this isn't new. However, MIDCO is implementing it in South Dakota. So this is the first time South Dakotans have seen 10G.
The bottom line is $500 million investment continuing to expand in South Dakota, and at the end of the day, I can watch videos faster. It's healthcare, it's all kinds of industry, but how does it affect the everyday consumer? How are we going to notice it in our homes and businesses?
Like McAdara said, he was excited about the improvement of latency. So that's the reaction time that the internet has. So there'll be less of that lag, which is super exciting for gamers. So if you're sitting at home playing Mario Kart, you don't have that delayed time. And also in our world of video and conference calling, it'll
sure.
help kind of mitigate those glitches and hopefully improve our video quality and all that. So.
Which helps telehealth and emergency care and mental health care across the state of South Dakota, hopefully in the days ahead. SDPB's Laura Johnson, thanks for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me.
Ahead on the program, SDPB's Lee Strubinger heads to the sale barn to look at the impact of the drought on South Dakota producers. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
I'm Jane Clayson. Black blues musician Daryl Davis has spent years fighting racism after bonding with a KKK member over music at a bar.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music. That was a seed planted.
How Davis sees white supremacy today, next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. The annual Arts Education Institute, Band Director Institute, and First Annual Choral Director Institute go online July 12th through the 16th with grad credit available. Register at artssouthdakota.org.
Sanford Underground Research Facilities' Neutrino Day Star Chronicles is going virtual July 9th and 10th. In our virtual town, you can talk with scientists, engineers, and educators. Explore interactive activities, experience some weird science, take virtual tours, and visit the art gallery and library. At our finale, learn about native ways of understanding the stars with keynote speaker Annette Lee. Join the fun. Go to neutrinoday.com.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Drought is taking a firm hold on the state. June was the driest month on record. Some ranchers are bracing for the conditions by thinning their herds. Others are holding on for as long as they can. SDPB's Lee Strubinger takes us to the north central part of the state for this story.
Orrin Lesmeister reaches down for a fistful of light brown grass. A dry clump of dirt easily comes up with it.
Right after 4th of July, typically, we'll start haying this ground here. It's gore green. It's got a lot of alfalfa in it, grass hay mix, native grass mix. And this year, you can kind of see what it's like, and then it's just dead dry.
As we stand in his field, wind rushes in from a low-pressure system of dark rain clouds that blanket the sky, skirting around his property. The radar makes it look like Dewey County could get rain, but not a drop has fallen near him, instead landing farther north.
And you think, boy, Dewey County's finally getting some rain, you know, parade area and stuff. And the reality is, we got nothing. I mean, just, we didn't get a sprinkle. It's been that way for months now.
Lesmeister spends part of his year in Pierre as a state lawmaker. He knows the issues in agriculture as a legislator and a rancher. He points to a land dam that should be full of water, but only has some stagnant moisture in it.
Pastures are getting depleted and short. Water supply is nil to void. As you can see, that should be a dam full of water there, and it looks like a green creek is all, you know, and that's all that's left of it. And this is what guys are up against, is they're just nothing for the cattle to eat.
And right now, his cows are drinking rural water. That's costing him more money. Lesmeister says this drought really started last September. He says some snow in October helped, but melted off quickly. The area got some spring showers, but nothing substantial. Drier conditions are leading some ranchers to thin their herds just to make it through the year. Baxter Anders is a co-owner of the Belfouge Livestock Market Sale Barn. He says the last week of June in 2020, they sold about 300 cattle. This year, that same week, they sold 10 times more cattle, 3,400 head in a week.
We just keep seeing more cattle coming, and coming from a big area, too.
Anders says for ranchers west of Belfouche, this is a second year of drought conditions.
That's kind of why it's increased in sales, and I think that's part of people's thinking in some ways is, you know, some people are holding on because maybe it is a little early yet and hopes that maybe the rain will come.
But the outlook for relief from drought conditions is slim. Laura Edwards is a state climatologist. She says this June was the driest on record, and those conditions are expected to continue well into July.
Really, I don't think we can overstate how severe extreme the conditions are right now, and they're going to be holding strong through the next month.
Edwards says this year's drought is bringing consistent evidence of how a changing climate affects weather. In the Northern Plains, there are big swings in extremes.
2 years ago from 2019. We had record wet conditions, and now we're in very dry conditions. We've seen this not too long in history. You know, 2011 was very wet, 2012 very dry. So I think these big swings and extremes are really kind of a story that we're going to be living here for a while.
Edwards says South Dakota does see a general long-term trend of wetter and warmer conditions, but that won't help right now. Scott Edoff is the president of the South Dakota Stock Growers Association. He says many ranchers know if they see two wet years in a row, a drought is on the way.
If you are patient and you realize that this is in a cycle, it's a life cycle. It's not something really bad, but it's a life cycle. And if you're prepared for it, you can expand, and there's a lot of opportunity there too.
Back in Dewey County, rancher Orrin Lesmeister drives north on some pasture, looking at the elusive rain clouds. He says being ready for changing weather conditions sounds smart, but it can take years for ranchers to build back their herds.
You don't just have a turnaround the next year and go buy back a whole bunch of cattle, because typically the prices are coming back up because pastures are green again and stuff, and everybody's looking for some cows. So it becomes a process to replace everything.
The state is stepping in to offer a bit of drought support for farmers and ranchers. Governor Kristi Noem is declaring a state of emergency in response. It lets farmers east of the Missouri River cut hay and ditches to use as livestock feed. The USDA is lifting restrictions on Conservation Reserve Program acres to alleviate feed shortages. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Parade.
You can find this story along with photos of the drought impact in South Dakota on our website at sdpb.org/news. Up next, teachers' unions prepare to defend members from lawsuits when they teach about race and racism in the classroom. The Dakota Political Junkies discuss. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, a turning point in the fight for women's reproductive rights. The 1873 Comstock Act virtually outlawed contraception. We'll talk about the man behind the law, anti-vice crusader Anthony Comstock, and the women prosecuted under that statute. They're the subject of a new book by Amy Sohn, who will be our guest. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
Miles Davis's love affair with France began the moment he first visited at the age of 22 in 1949. He returned to the country throughout his career and played one of his final concerts there in July of 1991. I'm Carl Gerke, and a previously unreleased recording of that concert is now available for the first time 30 years later. We'll hear a few selections this evening on Jazz Nightly. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by MITGO Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midco.com/business.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. One of America's largest teacher unions is prepared to defend teachers who get sued for talking about race and racism in their classrooms. It's all part of the political wrangling over what some call patriotic education. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. Pam Caribou is a professor of political science at Black Hills State University. And they're joining us today as part of our ongoing Dakota Political Junkies conversations. John Hunter, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for the invitation.
Dr. Pam Caribou, thanks for being here as well.
Hi, Lori. Good to be here.
Pam, I want to start with you because you're so good at sort of encapsulating this whole concept of critical race theory and all the misunderstandings about it. So right now, often it's being used as this umbrella term. And when classroom teachers are talking about racism, you know, in the context of history or in the context of literature, it's unlikely that they're actually teaching critical race theory. But How did this all become such a news story?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. First, you know, people think critical race theory is this thing where, you know, we scold all the white people for being oppressors and classify all the black people as hopeless victims, that it makes children feel bad about themselves. There's a bunch of shame and guilt. But actually, critical race theory doesn't ascribe racism to white people as individuals or even as a group. Instead, it focuses on U.S. institutions and systems, basically arguing that these systems were built when racism was prevalent, and they still retain racist components today that lead to differential outcomes by race, or you could even do this and talk about it by gender. So racism can still exist without racists. That's critical race theory in a nutshell. But I don't think we're really debating about critical race theory in any of these conversations. I mean, I thank you for the opportunity to kind of clarify what it means, but this is a moral panic that's being used for political purposes. It's like all the people in the 1980s that were very worried about, you know, rock music and Satanism and that kind of thing. It's a convenient political tool more so than a serious conversation about race or critical race theory or even what should or shouldn't be taught in public education.
Yeah. John Hunter, some of these conversations seem to be designed to do just that, shut down any thoughtful conversation about any of this, whether it's about history or education or the founding fathers, to throw out words like honest education or patriarch education, and then all of a sudden, you know, conversation over. So same question to you. How is this becoming such a big story? Where every magazine that you see on the newsstand and every newspaper and everyone's weighing in on education and history all of a sudden.
Yeah, it is, I think, a real anomaly in our educational curriculum process where you get politics so involved in kind of this thing, too. And it is such a big issue. I think Pam established a nice foundation in just a few sentences, but it's so big and it has so many components to it. But, you know, I saw a quote within the last week or so, and they're talking about political labels. And so that's whether it's your party or you're conservative or liberal or whatever you are. And it said, as soon as you assign a label, the thinking stops. And that seems to be kind of where this has come on this discussion of teaching history, is that it has become a labeled, that Republicans feel one way, Democrats feel another, conservatives this way. And the thinking has kind of stopped, or the discussion maybe at least about that. I don't think it's as hard as people are making it. I think you do as much research and show as much of what really happened. And I think further research adds to that. You know, Laurie, you and I talked about that a couple of months ago, where you just kind of, the more you learn, the more you add to this conversation, and try not to go overboard on any of these things. Try to do the best you can, explain kind of what happened, maybe some of the circumstances of the day, how thought processes were different then, and then move along. But it has become very politicized, and people seem to be taking one side or the other and not looking for solutions in the middle.
Yeah. So what's at stake? Is it then a red herring topic that, you know, even Governor Noem or other lawmakers and politicians can get distracted with, away from the real work of that the people of South Dakota need done on their behalf? Or is it a launching pad and a banner topic for something that people really care about and kind of launches Governor Noem into this national foray a little bit? And Pam, I'll give you first crack at that one.
Well, I think I think you're right. I mean, it's certainly being used as a political tool, and certainly, you know, campaigns are often built around those kinds of emotional appeals. But my problem is that it'll have real consequences for K-12 education and actually higher ed, college education as well, because a lot of the legislation that's being passed, and right now six states have passed critical race theory legislation, but only one of those actually mentions critical race theory. Instead, the legislation is overbroad. It bans discussions about bias, about discrimination, about oppression, about privilege, and also even applies it to gender as well as race. And so that's real legislation that will affect the way teachers behave in the classroom, and that leads to the point that you made about teachers' unions needing to provide a defense fund for those who are sued over critical race theory. Mm-hmm. At worst, we'll have teachers being sued. Maybe not at worst. Maybe this is also worse, that will have a chilling effect on what is taught. Teachers won't feel safe talking about real American history.
Interesting. John, is this similar at all to the battle over science education and teaching of evolution? Are we seeing, you know, echoes of that, or is this a whole new creature?
Well, I think it does have some similarities, and I hadn't thought about that before you just brought that up, but there are some elements of that, I think, here too. I find interesting there are specialists all over the country in curriculum development, and they know kind of how to put these things together. And that's not to say they know everything, because they don't. But I would, as much as you can, try to involve, you know, people who aren't running for office or aren't currently in office, and utilize expertise in developing curriculums. And, you know, South Dakota, and I think America to a sense, has tried to rely on local control of that, you know, all the way down to the individual school district level. And the more this kind of slides up the scale, first to the state level and then to the federal level, and I'm not saying it's not there now, because there are a lot of those things coming down from Washington, D.C., but try to involve kind of non-political people in the curriculum development as best you can.
Mm. You mentioned, Pam, the real impact on teachers, and that brings us to school boards and school board meetings, because when we think back to some of the city council meetings or, you know, issues that municipalities had when it was, the conversation was a mask mandate, and there was just a lot of political weighing in on that. People showed up at these, you know, city council meetings in droves. Do you think we have the potential for seeing some of that vitriol spill over into public school board meetings, where crowds come and, you know, demand a certain kind of action that might not be connected to the actual curriculum development or how teachers teach?
Oh, absolutely. I think your reference to those mask mandate meetings is right on track for South Dakota, but actually across the country and other states, they've already seen school board meetings on this critical race theory topic or discrimination or racism that have played out exactly the way you described. So we could definitely see, I expect we will see that in South Dakota.
Yeah. Does anything good come from this conversation? John Hunter? Is there a silver lining to all of this at all? Because I got to be honest, I'm not seeing one. I'm seeing a lot of argument, and I'm seeing a lot of excuses for actual white supremacy in action, and some really hurtful and hateful things being said. I'm struggling to find my optimistic, well, at least we're all talking about this kind of fallback, feeling a little lost. Do you see any positives to the conversation?
Well, I do, and that's part of it's just my nature that I try to find something very early on that might be a beacon of light in there. And the thing that I can think of in this is that even for school board discussions and parents and other people attending school board things, it's a participation in that process. And that is, you know, apathy is not a good thing either for most of this. You know, I recall school board meetings when people are talking about book burning and, you know, what should be in the school library and those sorts of things. And overall, I think, you know, getting people involved and maybe even passionate about some of these things is a healthy process. I tend to be one who believes apathy when it comes to schools or all sorts of things is not healthy at all. So I guess I don't mind a little bit of discussion about this, even though it doesn't always make sense and sometimes people aren't always logical. Having those school board meetings where you can talk about these things, I do think it's better than apathy.
Pam, from
does that help?
You know, it's funny that you talk about book burning, because one of the things when we, you know, always talk as journalists about, you know, things that you can cover impartially. And, you know, I think I always just say, honestly, well, don't send me to cover the book burning rally, because I have pretty strong opinions that I might have a hard time. I'll opt out of that.
And we'll send, my job is trying to get you, your blood pressure up.
We'll send somebody else to cover that story, because I honestly don't know if I can do it. Pam, the impact on higher education, is there a silver lining here with maybe, and I guess what I'm stretching for is that maybe some people had never really thought about this, or some people, you know, were like, critical race, what? And all of a sudden they're thinking about, you know, admissions in new ways, or housing in new ways, or students trying to figure out, you know, how to become an engineer or a lawyer, and unpacking how systems are established in this country and what kind of dismantling or rethinking needs to happen. Any silver linings there?
I do think so. I hadn't really thought of the way you framed the question. I would hope that those conversations were already happening in higher education.
Sure.
Although this is another perfect example of that, you know, when you're discussing systems like this, you can't ignore the political, which is gratifying to a political scientist like me. But I was thinking, actually, outside of higher ed, because of this issue, I was able to have, you know, just a casual conversation with my dad about what is critical race theory, and I was able to just kind of explain what it is and how it was, you know, how it's being portrayed versus what it really does. And he's like, oh, that's what that is. Oh, now I understand. So I don't have any kind of illusion that I would be able to convince, or we would be able to convince everybody what this is, you know, what's the issue here, what is critical race theory talking about. But we will have more of these kinds of personal, quiet conversations with people and expand the discussion in a way that I think can be very productive.
Yeah.
We're not going to convince everybody, but we can convince many people if we take the time to explain what's the issue, what's the problem, what are we trying to solve.
Yeah. One of my most enjoyable questions lately has been just asking people what, you know, a patriotic education is, or what is patriotism to you? Because sometimes they'll say, well, it should be more patriotic. And I say, well, what does that mean to you? And it always kind of gets a pause to say, oh, what do I mean? And then it helps people think more deeply about mm-hmm. how they feel about their country and why they think it's exceptional versus just, hey, we're exceptional. And that started some really interesting, rich conversations in my personal life with people who maybe haven't put a lot of thought into that before. So, boy, we're optimists. And speaking of optimism, John Hunter, you wrote in the Madison Daily Leader about really needing to push a little further toward this vaccination goal because we're a little bit at risk because of the number of people who have opted out of getting vaccinated. Tell us a little bit about why this was an important thing to throw your weight behind still here in July.
One thing that I think that I did not include in that editorial that some people don't know, there have been more deaths from COVID-19 this year, the first 6 months of the year, than all of last year. And mm-hmm. so for most of us in well-vaccinated countries and states, then we think, oh, this basically is over. It was, you know, it had its peak in November or whatever it was. But around the world, there are outbreaks. There are outbreaks in America, in the United States, in certain states that are having this surge. And so I would love to see a new, renewed encouragement of vaccinations. And if you look at the people who have not yet been vaccinated, yes, there are some people who are basing that decision on a conspiracy theory that
they're injecting us with microchips or something that'll track us or something. But I think most of the people are just are more of the casual, like, yeah, I'll get vaccinated sometime, or, you know, I'm young and healthy, so even if I got it, it's not that bad. And,
sure,
you know, just kind of this middle ground. And I think some encouragement can bring that, bring those people into the fold. And you can see I'm a believer in it. I mean, not everyone is, but I am, and most of America is. But I think the last 10-20% I think need some encouragement. And a lot of states have done that. And South Dakota has, I have not seen as many of those incentives. So, you know, Minnesota next door, you know, offering free tickets to the state fair or to Twins games, or the funniest one I saw was a shot for a shot, where you'd get a beer or something, or some alcoholic beverage for getting vaccinated. But I think we can do that. And I think we can do that in a local level too, whether it's in Lake County or Minnehaha County or any other place, is to try to encourage in it. And who knows, you get another 5%, that could matter. We don't know.
Right.
And so I would love to see our vaccination number push forward and maintain the progress that we've made already.
Through and possibly not only honing messaging, but providing some, you know, creative incentives, perhaps from business or private. And that's so interesting, because I think about going on an orchestra trip for my daughter's high school not too long ago, a couple years now, and we were all eating at Subway or something, and, you know, the kids were, you know, sending a text for a free cookie, you know, and giving up their data just to get a cookie. And, well, if, you know, maybe it just takes a cookie. People,
well,
will.
I was surprised. Yeah. I looked at a website that had, you know, kind of COVID-19 vaccination incentives.
Yeah.
And I was surprised in how many national firms, retail stores and so forth, that would say kind of 10% off any purchase made on a day that you're vaccinated.
Sure.
Either show a card or do it in their store, pharmacy, or wherever. I was surprised at how many, and a lot of other institutions are trying to help, and, you know, trying to in some small way do that. And that there might be some people on the fence who would take advantage of the, get the free cookie if you're vaccinated.
It's my metaphor, my cookie metaphor for the day. All right, John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. Pam Caravu is professor of political science at Black Hills State University. Professor Caravu, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Lori.
Publisher emeritus John Hunter, thank you as well.
Thanks, Lori and Pam. Take care.
Let's take a moment now to honor inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for the 2020 class of inductees has been scheduled for September 10th and 11th of this year. Let's start with Mike Cartney. U.S. Senator Larry Pressler appointed Mike Cartney to the U.S. Air Force Academy. Once he retired from the Air Force, Cartney came back to South Dakota and for the past three decades has helped transform the state's technical college system. Cartney is currently president of Lake Area Technical Institute in Watertown.
I spent 30 years in the military through a variety of assignments. This was our 19th move coming home to South Dakota. But the throughout the years, there was always a focus in the military on technical education, making sure that people understand, you know, what their job is, how to do it, how to do it best. And so it was kind of a natural fit when you combine that kind of background with all the leadership and command experience that someone brings coming out of the military. It fit nicely with Lake Area Technical College when I came home. Extremely pleased that they were nice enough to offer me a position when I returned. Probably the biggest emphasis has been that, you know, there is a strong connection between higher education and careers and higher education and your workforce. In fact, when we first started off, we started talking about that, you know, education is economic development. And, you know, that we've evolved and sharpened that message to recognize that, you know, your institutes of higher education have to be community and industry facing. You know, they take their cues on what is success and set their goals based upon what they hear from industry and what our industry's needs. And that's probably been the biggest topic that we've taken on, whether it was here locally, at the state level, or nationally. Well, probably the biggest thing is, you know, this is home for me. I was born and raised in the central part of South Dakota, down in the Presho, Murdo, Pukawana, you know, in those areas. So, you know, this is home for me, and this is where everything that I put to good use in the military, those core values, all those things came from being raised in South Dakota and raised with that strong family background and a background in integrity and honor that you get from being raised in the agriculture communities and small communities across South Dakota.
That's Mike Cartney, president of Lake Area Technical Institute. He's also a 2020 inductee into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. You can hear from more members of the South Dakota Hall of Fame throughout this summer on Wednesdays on In the Moment. Ahead on the program, we take a trip to the Bramble Park Zoo in Watertown with 605 Magazine on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Jane Clayson. Black blues musician Daryl Davis has spent years fighting racism after bonding with a KKK member over music at a bar.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music, that was a seed planted.
How Davis sees white supremacy today, next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
Hey, you remember those searches high and low for toilet paper and masks and gloves back in the beginning of this thing? Well, now businesses are trying to avoid those kinds of shortages in the future.
They're trying to overorder to fill their inventory to support their customers because they're seeing such strong demand through the cycle.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, stockpiling, making a comeback next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. For more than a century, people have stopped in Watertown to get up close and personal with amphibians, reptiles, birds, fish, and mammals of all kinds. The Bramble Park Zoo has been one of Watertown's big attractions for decades. Alana Snyder of 605 Magazine recently got a behind-the-scenes look at the zoo, and she is joining us to talk about her work in the 605 Magazine July issue, as you are the publisher of said magazine. Put all that backwards.
And as a junior zookeeper.
Now you are a junior zookeeper and golf cart riding zoo visitor as
yes.
well. So you headed to Watertown for this happy summer. Happy July.
Hey, you too.
Yeah.
It feels like July. Finally, it feels like July.
It definitely
It's been
feels
July,
like July
all through June, too, with the humidity. So.
Exactly. It has been hot, but that's kind of still a nice day to get out to the zoo.
It's great.
If you're prepared properly for it. Tell me about Bramble Park, because I have not been there.
Yeah, so it was my first time really exploring it, so it was amazing to do such a behind-the-scenes. And I didn't know how much I'd get to see, but I got to see a lot. So I arrived, and there's a Terry Redlin exhibit inside, which is gorgeous, too, and just those animals. And, like, there's a huge turtle, all these types of fish. Like, the nature in there is amazing just to start. And then you walk out, and Dan Miller, who's been there for over 30 years, he's kind of like a legend in tourism. He's awesome. And he gave me the tour in a golf cart. And he took me everywhere from, they have so many monkeys, so we went through the monkey exhibits. I got to watch them have snacks. I got to feed a camel, which was adorable.
Nice.
I got to meet a sloth in their cage.
These are some of my favorite animals, the sloths.
Oh, the sloth was just chilling as usual.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then he didn't even tell us what was next, and he brought us to this building. And he was like, okay, just walk inside. I'm going to wait out here. And so I went with Catherine from the Watertown Convention and Visitors Bureau, and we walked in, and there's these two black bears just, like, in a cage. And I'm like, what am I walking into? I had no idea. So I was like, hey, what's going on? And it was just nerve-wracking. They weren't doing anything, but, you know, you're in a room with two bears. And he's like, oh, yeah, we're just cleaning the exhibit, and they're getting ready to feed. And so we wanted you guys to see the whole experience of them going and getting food. So they legit had – they released them, and they had a whole picnic with a picnic table. And they just hopped up and actually were in the picnic table, and then the guy let me go in the exhibit.
Wow.
Which we've all seen on CNN, and it does not end well. But mine did.
Because you were under the very close supervision. Listeners, take note. Yes. You cannot go in the exhibit on your own. This is very bad.
No.
However, for the purposes of the story and education, because this is an accredited zoo and there really aren't that many accredited zoos. And that is a very important distinction. Tell us a little bit why, I mean, the practices are a little elevated as far as managing the zoo and working on with, you know, breeding animals for other zoos across the country. Tell us a little bit about that for Bramble Park.
I think they said it's like 200 or under that are actually accredited. So it's Bramble Park Zoo and then the Great Plains Zoo and Sioux Falls that are both accredited. And it's really not easy to get that accreditation. And it's just all on the staff. It's the care that they give the animals, the type of animals that they're taking care of and making sure that they don't go extinct. And
Species protection and some really solid science going on.
Oh, yeah.
In those zoos. Still, it's kind of fun to watch the bears sit at a picnic table.
I mean, it really is. Like, they had watermelons, donuts. They were feeling it. And, yeah, the guy had me right next to him. Everywhere else is very safe. And then he pulled me back the second the meal was over because, like, you know, once you're done with your treats, then I want to be out of sight.
Sure.
So we went back around. We saw the kids' zoo, which was awesome. I got to meet a yak and pet a yak and take a selfie with one. So that was nice. But the zoo is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I can't stress that enough. And on top of it, I love that on hot days that we've had lately, like they have misters all over. So, you know, if you're feeling kind of hot, you can take a break, go under the misters. But each exhibit was more gorgeous than the last. And it's just a really impressive zoo that is – and there's so much to do in Watertown. So go take a day trip. Go spend the weekend. It's a really fun town to explore restaurant-wise and with the zoo.
Terry Redlin, you mentioned his name at first. For newcomers to South Dakota or some of those visitors, we better put some context into the Terry Redlin experience because he's one of our state's most widely known artists.
Yeah.
All over Watertown, opportunities there.
Yeah, so Watertown is really known for Terry Redlin, and you can also go to the – is it the Terry Redlin Center or Art Center? I'm not sure. I'm probably butchering the actual name. But you can pull off the interstate and go to that as well, and he's known for his nature art and is just a very, very nationally, internationally talented artist that really captures nature really perfectly and kind of the whole, like, family life and all of that. So, yeah, like, he loved nature. Clearly.
Right.
So, and they have a whole thing too where a lot of their funds go to water preservation, and they really push that too in the Terry Redlin Center because he was in the zoo because he was really passionate about getting clean water and everything.
Right. And that is, you know, one of the things that, you know, South Dakota visitors come here for these outdoor experiences and getting up close and personal with some of these animals help us appreciate. And this is all part of a conservation conversation. It's all part of a human connection conversation plus a little bit of fun.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. 605 Magazine on stands now. You can learn more at 605magazine.com, right?
Correct.
And Bramble Park Zoo. More information is available at brambleparkzoo.com. Alana Snyder, thank you. Always a joy to see you. Where are you going next?
Where am I going next? Who knows? I just got back from Springfield, South Dakota yesterday.
Knows where she will go
I might
next.
Go to Lemon in a couple weeks.
Nice. All right. Come back and tell us about that.
I will.
Thank you. The The South Dakota Arts Council has purchased 13 new artworks for the state art collection. Sarah Carlson is arts program coordinator with the South Dakota Arts Council, and she's joining us now on the phone to talk about the project from Pier. Sarah Carlson, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Talk a little bit about this state art collection from a big picture, and then let's get into a little bit about how acquisitions are made and where they're displayed. But overall, the state has an art collection?
The state does have an art collection. The program is called Art for State Buildings. And if you kind of look at it from a perspective, it's a little bit like having one large collection that's like a gallery in a whole bunch of different buildings in Pier. And it began in 2008 for the purpose of showcasing the work of all of our talented South Dakota artists and to build a permanent state art collection for display in mm-hmm. publicly accessible areas of state government buildings in our capital city.
Nice. All right. So it expands every year. How does the submission and selection process work?
Sure. So there are five members of an advisory committee to the South Dakota Arts Council, and the proposals are reviewed by this group, and every year in the spring, there is a request for proposals that's sent out publicly, and artists involved with creating art, visual art, will apply and send in their proposals, and then over a course of a month or so, this advisory committee reviews all of these proposals and works to work within a budget and make selection recommendations.
All right. How are we doing as far as incubating and celebrating the next generation of artists?
How are we? Well, it is a tough decision when you're looking at all of these different types of art. It is everything from weavings to printmaking to paintings, sculpture, and the selection of artwork is based on the quality of the work, and you know it's a South Dakota collection, so it's also based on the artwork's relevance to South Dakota environment,
sure.
history, heritage, culture, and then also as required for public artworks, the permanence and the safety of the pieces and the professional experience of the artist.
Yeah,
and so that's some of the things that we look at, or I should say, the selection committee looks at in reviewing these pieces.
I'm looking at the list of some of the most recent purchases, and some familiar names on here, like Claire Lockhart and Deborah Mitchell and Wade Patton, people who've been guests on this show before. But a lot of newcomers to me, people that I don't know their work, and I'm excited to learn more. Tell me about this latest group of acquisitions.
I think what is interesting when you're looking through them, and I know we don't have a whole lot of time, but the stories behind the pieces are also something that we're working to enhance for the public to understand a little bit about the artist and a little bit about the artist's work. And each piece has a story and a reason. We've got, when you're looking down the list, we've got people who do this professionally. We have a couple of teachers involved. We have a couple of people who are just getting into coming from a different discipline, arts discipline, that are now doing photography. Such a wide variety, and I think that's what's so much fun from my chair here in Pier is to be able to kind of enjoy being a viewer and seeing all of these different types of art.
Tell me one story.
Pick one and tell me a story.
Yeah,
sure. Let me pick one out. I think one of the ones that I noticed that we've got here hanging on the wall before it gets placed or installed in its new location. It is still in our office. It is called Wedding Dress Burial. Mm. And it is by Jill Kokesh, and she's of Fort Pier, and she is a teacher for Riggs High School here in Pier. It's a gelatin silver print, and it is a stark black and white image of a wedding dress that is standing on its own in a way in a field, in a dug up soil filled area in a field, and there's a farm in the background, and there's a story there of love and loss. Mm. And those
those images when our people are walking through the hallway here, whether they're visitors to our building or they're employees, they stop, they look, and they want to know more about it. And I think we're serving the public in that way through this entire program because it gives people a chance to understand South Dakota and its stories and also its history in that way. That's one of those images that makes you stop and go, I wonder what's happening in this, in the content of this image.
How do our artists then, you know, when you talk about people just walking by, people who, you know, are maybe not artists themselves, who don't, you know, stop at a gallery, for example, or, you know, make that part of their South Dakota visitors experience, and yet it can freeze you in your place and change your day. What is the role of our South Dakota artists in helping us see ourselves and helping us see outside of ourselves?
Well, I think that it goes hand in hand with the mission of the South Dakota Arts Council. So our goal continues, and it's to build this art collection specifically for people to view and appreciate the work of South Dakota artists, and also to support the arts business in our state by paying artists for work, the work they do. But it also allows the public to appreciate the vast difference in artists and also how we put them on a pedestal for the public. We're hand-in-hand with tourism.
Yeah.
And we're hand-in-hand with the history, tourism, and we're an attraction in that way. And it's kind of a little difficult to answer the question. We don't make definitions for the artists. We don't expect the artists to define themselves to us. And, you know, the arts can change, like you just said, change your day.
Yeah.
As we noticed this last year.
And your life.
You up. It's interpretation at its finest, I think.
So the full list of Arts for State Buildings collection, and each location is at artscouncil.sd.us. And I'm just wondering what happens next after a piece of art is acquired. Then how is it placed in its new location?
Sure. And Lori, I'll go back to our website. It's actually artscouncil.sd.
Okay. Artscouncil.sd.gov. Sorry about that.
Correct. Yep, no problem. So the next thing that happens is we take these pieces that are currently in our building, and we work with the requests that are coming from state agencies throughout Pierre. There's been some buildings that have been remodeled that have more wall space. We have a relocating of pieces that have maybe been in a spot for quite some time. And it's a little bit of project management that happens next. We find what pieces work best for the spaces that are open, and they will be installed in this next month in state buildings for the enjoyment of visitors and citizens and employees of South Dakota. And that's pretty exciting. We're also going to be using social media platforms to tell the stories behind these pieces and where they end up, and then some photos with the artists with their pieces in those buildings and here in town. So it's a really exciting time for us.
Sarah Carlson is with the South Dakota Arts Council, artscouncil.sd.gov. Sarah, thank you so much for bringing this story to us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.